Coming up next hour, we'll take your questions and comments for Dr. Tudor Parfit. He was the subject recently of an article entitled "Sorry, Indiana Jones, the Ark of the Covenant is not inside this Ethiopian church." And it was the story that we've been telling you for the last hour or so about the observation made by Dr. Edward Ullendorf, who saw what was supposedly the Ark of the Covenant during World War II and revealed that what is inside the church is actually a replica of the Ark, and that he kept that to himself largely while he was alive. He did mention it in one piece to a newspaper, but he didn't, other than that 1992 interview with the Los Angeles Times, he didn't talk about it because he didn't want to offend the Ethiopians, pointing out that that thing that they're guarding is just a, you know, it's a recent, some modern manufactured ark. It's not the ark, not the one that was smuggled out of Israel, having been stolen from King Solomon by the son of the Queen of Sheba, according to Ethiopian tradition. But if you scroll down in the story, it says this: nobody knows where the actual Ark of the Covenant is hiding or whether it really exists. Well, that wasn't the impression I had after the research of Dr. Parfit when he was on back in 2010 or 11. I can't remember the last time. All I remember is he had me convinced I knew where it was. And I'll ask him about that next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Ponet. So, by the way, I think I mentioned, Tudor, that since our last conversation, I left Coast to Coast and I went back and got my PhD, and now I'm teaching and just doing Coast from time to time. So I have an even greater appreciation of your list of publications and where your work has been featured. Pretty darn cool. So your work in Jewish antiquities in particular, understanding these alternative narratives, and I say alternative meaning that you were discovering along the way some aspects of Jewish history which had been lost to the world. For example, the Lemba tribe of southern Africa, who claimed descent from some ancient Jewish population. And I thought what was really cool is even they weren't sure, if I remember correctly, according to your documentaries in the book, they weren't even sure exactly why they did certain things. They just knew it was part of their tribal tradition. Is that right?
Yeah, that is, I suppose, correct. Yeah.
They were a group which you studied, and that you did some DNA studies of the males of that group?
Yeah, that's right. I came across this group. It's a smallish tribe in Zimbabwe and in the northeast area of the Republic of South Africa. Back in the, a long time ago, back in the 1980s. And, you know, I was very intrigued by these people. They wore little Jewish skull caps, yarmulkes, or kippot, on their heads. And they claimed to have come from a place called Sena in the north and to be a lost tribe of Israel. And, you know, they didn't really have much in the way of proof. They didn't have any ancient text in support of this idea. But the story of how they came from Sena and the journey that they embarked upon was very detailed. And they had an oral tradition, such as many societies in Africa do have, which seemed to be consistent and extremely interesting. So I set off anyway and tried to do the same journey that they'd done, coming from Israel through to Central Africa, or from Sena down to Central Africa, in reverse, starting in Central Africa and then working my way following the oral tradition from village to village, from mountain to mountain, from stream to stream, and to see where it got me. And it didn't. It got me as far as the Indian Ocean, but there the trail went dry, and I wasn't really able to answer the question of where Sena was. And it was only a few years later, when I was doing another book in the Yemen, that I found what I thought might be a clue in the fact that I discovered a place called Sena, which had been abandoned probably 1,000 years earlier, and from which there was a tradition of emigration to Africa. So it was at that point that I decided to do a comparison of the DNA of the people living in this town of Sena and the original Lemba tribe in Central Africa with its claims of being Jewish. And there was quite a good match. And really, the story starts there. And as more DNA work was done on the tribe, we discovered that, and this was really a very, very cool piece of research. And in order to explain that, I just have to sort of step back and evoke the Jewish priesthood. Now, as everybody knows, the people who functioned in the temple in Jerusalem were the priests, and the Hebrew word for priest is kohen, kohanim is the plural. And there are still to this day people called kohen, and everybody knows probably a Jewish person called kohen, and it means that probably he is derived eventually from a priest who worked in who functioned in the temple in Jerusalem. So at this point, it occurred to one or two of us that the status of the Y chromosome and the status of being a priest were the same, because you get your Y chromosome from your father, he gets it from his father, he gets it from his father. And this is a kind of unending chain going back through history. The Y chromosome hardly changes from one generation to the next. And what you've got is what your very, very distant male ancestor would have. In the same way, you can only be a priest if your father was a priest, and if his father was a priest, and if his father was a priest, going way back into history. And so we thought that it would be very interesting to see what happened if we collected the DNA of a number of priests, what would we find? And what we found was amazing, because truth is, you wouldn't really probably think that Mr. Cohen down the block has really, after all these hundreds and thousands of years, got anything to do with with the high priest in Jerusalem. But it turned out that 55% of the people that we tested, in fact, had the same genetic signature. And that genetic signature implied that they were descended from a single individual who lived in the Middle East around 3,000 years ago. And that idea was a very attractive idea. It got a lot of it garnered a lot of interest throughout the world, because 3,000 years ago is more or less the time of Moses, and of course it was the brother of Moses, Aaron, who was the founder of the priesthood. So it looked like we had found the Moses gene, and that's the way that it was represented in the in a lot of the newspaper and other media kind of reports of this. Of this research. So that's one thing, the Moses gene, the gene of the priesthood. And we discovered then, subsequently, that in this Lemba tribe, going back to Central Africa, with its claim of being Jewish, that they had a priestly clan. And when we looked at the DNA of this priestly clan, lo and behold, what we discovered was that they had exactly the same incidence of this, what was called the Cohen modal haplotype, or the priest signature, as Jews, generally speaking, throughout the world did. Now, this was a very, very exciting discovery, because, A, it tended to give support to the idea that these people really were Jewish, even though nobody in the world ever heard of them, even though there was not a single record anywhere in the annals of Jewish or other history suggesting that there was any legitimacy to their claim. And, you know, it was kind of very exciting, the idea that everybody carries around in their body a kind of history book of their own past. It was a very intriguing idea, and of course it was a new idea in the 1990s. Now we all know about this, but right. Then people didn't know about it. And so if you look at the history book inside you, you can see probably where you came from in the distant past. And so that was it. And so when you put together the story of this tribe as revealed through their DNA, and then connected it with the oral traditions that they had carried with them throughout their peregrinations in Africa and elsewhere, you've got an intriguing story which has got some reference to the Ark of the Covenant.
Yeah. Amazing. Also, I guess it should be noted that there, according to some traditions, Moses himself was Ethiopian, right? There are some people who maintain that the story of the Exodus and, you know, Moses going to Pharaoh and then leaving again was all about Ethiopia, not about Israel. I don't know what your position on that is, but I know some people who truly believe that and use as evidence of that that Ethiopians were held in very high regard in the biblical tradition all the way into the Christian New Testament, where in Ethiopians, appreciation of Christianity was considered the highest compliment.
Yes, I think there are many people who do believe this.
So, but still very interesting, however we slide that around, that it goes back to some part in it has some connection to that to the Middle East, that this Y chromosome can be traced all the way back there. I though also think that part of the confusion that I think some people have is something that you've disseminated for me, which is that there was more than, according to rabbinic tradition, there was more than one ark.
Well, that's right. In fact, it's not even rabbinic tradition. According to the Bible,
right,
itself, you know, there are two very distinct traditions, and they're not, they can't be reflective of the same event, because one of them involves Moses going up Mount Sinai and being instructed to create an ark himself to carry the tablets of the law back down to the to where the Israelites were in the valley. The other story is of the Israelites themselves creating this glorious, beautiful ark out of gold and acacia wood. And we even know the name of the artisan who was responsible for its fabrication, for its construction, and that was one Bezalel. So, you know, very different stories. One is a simple thing created with a penknife on the mountain, and the other is something that was created by this skilled workman of precious gold and other, you know, wonderful things. So it's not the same thing, and so as rabbis were looking at the inconsistency in the story, they had to resolve it, and they came up with the idea that the one thing was the kind of ceremonial ark, and it was the ceremonial ark that eventually found its way to the temple, and eventually found its way into the Holy of Holies in the temple. That was one ark. And then there was the other ark, which was the simple kind of portable ark that was actually the ark that the Israelite armies took with them when they went into battle. And of course, it was considered to have magic powers and almost to ensure victory in any conflict. And this story of the, you know, the invincible Ark of War, which one, it was one that was carried on in other Middle Eastern societies, and we have reflections of that in Arabic sources over many, many hundreds of years. And so the idea of the Ark of War leading, you know, Muslim armies, for instance, is one that's there in the sources. So there's something of a discrepancy between these two arcs, and as the rabbis, you know, themselves saw.
And yet, as you say, too, tradition attempted to reconcile them, and most people, if you asked, would say that they were the same. In fact, even came up last night in Open Lines, somebody had mentioned, you know, that carrying that gold ark, you know, forward into battle, that it was acted as like a giant battery that channeled energy, that was part of it, like it was like weaponized. And that's another kind of story that gets told about the ark. And that, I think, it's this notion of the very simple ark, this you know, this wooden ark, this is the part that I think is, like, people, perhaps I say people, I'm triangulating or I'm making a strong argument, but I think maybe at some point I couldn't get my head around the idea that the ark was really just this simple thing, almost a drum, and that this drum is part of what is actually the real tradition of what the ark really was and what the remnant of it is. And so your research was instrumental, I think, in changing the way a lot of people looked at what the Ark was and where it has been all these years. So where is it all these years later? And what are do you have any new developments in your research regarding the Ark? And I guess I probably don't want to get you to go too deep into it, because I'm only going to have to stop you anyway, because you're coming up at the bottom of the hour. Do what you can here and just be prepared that I may have to hold you over in the answer. But where is it right now? And where does your research stand?
Well, I haven't been working on this recently. I've been working the last few years on another book. But I think, you know, what I wrote a couple of years back, 2 or 3 years back, stands, that the object that I found, I think it's got something to do with the Ark of the Covenant. I'm not saying it is the Ark of the Covenant. I'm saying it's got something to do with the Ark of the Covenant. I think the story of the Lemba similarly has got something to do with the Ark of the Covenant. And it's probably the closest thing that we've got, because, you know, people come up with books, or every couple of years there's something, and, you know, they sell them for a lot of money and they make themselves rich. But at the end of the day, they don't have an object. There is nothing to look at. And in this particular case, there is an object. And the you know, the story that attaches to the object is a very interesting and very intriguing story, and you know, one could easily kind of construct a tale which connects it with the original Ark of the Covenant, using the evidence that I've mentioned. DNA is one, oral traditions of the tribe is another. And then the kind of, you know, various inconsistencies in the biblical text, as well as you know, some of the legends in Arabic sources. So altogether, there's a kind of new way of looking at what it might have been. And if you recall the fact that you know, the Ark of the Covenant, as described, would have been impossible for people to carry. It was just too heavy, and it could never have been used in the way that it was described as being used. It was supposed to be carried on poles through, you know, through rings on the corner of the ark. No pole could have carried the weight of gold that was involved in its manufacture, and no men would have been strong enough to carry it, four men, to battle. And so, therefore, it was something else. And the rabbis have pointed in this direction. The story of the Lemba points in this direction. Quite what the technology was, we do not know. But the idea of...
Well, this is where you got to hang on to that thought. So we'll come back to that, just like I feared. And so we'll talk about what the rabbis say, or what the tribe says, too, on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Dr. Tudor Parfit, will update us here in just a second. He was just doing that before the bottom of the hour break, so we'll get the latest on his research, such as it is. He said he'd sort of left the study of the Ark, what it is, where it is, a couple of years ago, and turned him into a new direction. So I want to ask about that, too, because before we get to your calls coming up next hour, just how many Jewish communities, ancient Jewish communities like the Lemba tribe of Africa or the Jewish communities of Ethiopia, how many of them are there around the world? And how did they get there? We'll talk about that next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. So we were just talking about the Lemba tribe and this lost ark. I mean, you wrote, I think one of the last books I had you on for was The Lost Ark of the Covenant, Solving the 2,500-Year-Old Mystery of the Fabled Biblical Ark. Or it could have been after one of the specials. I can't remember. But what was interesting was that I believe you were sort of an impasse with the Zimbabwe Museum of Human Sciences or whatever it was, that you wanted to do testing on what you thought was either a remnant of the original Ark of War that was carried away from Israel, this drum-shaped object, or it was a replica of a remnant of that. And so how did that finally land?
Yeah, the thing really was that the Lemba tradition had it that that an original, if not the original, had blown up hundreds of years before. And they put a date on this in their oral tradition of around 1600. Now, we don't know whether that's the actual date or not. But anyway, it was hundreds of years before the original ark or an original ark blew up. And according to what they said was that they took a bit of the original ark and they fashioned a new ark on the core, if you like, of an original one. And so, I mean, the ark that we have, we know what the date is. It's actually the oldest wooden object ever discovered in sub-Saharan Africa, according to the British Museum experts who looked at it in the Department of Archaeology at Oxford University. And so the thing is pretty, it's obviously pretty old, pretty battered. It's been used. It was hidden in a cave, allegedly, perhaps for hundreds of years. And it would be very, very interesting to be able to test it for trace elements and for other things. For instance, we don't know what kind of wood it is. The biblical account talks about a very, very hard wood that grows in the Sinai Desert, and which, if the story is true in the first instance, would have been a probable source for making anything out of wood. But we don't know that this is made of. We don't know that this is made of acacia. And one of the experts who looked at the photograph of the object said he thought it was more likely to be a lowland fig. Now, I don't know whether this is true or not.
Right.
All
yeah.
I can say is it's a very, very, very hard wood. And we also know that acacia is a very, very hard wood. The last I heard, excuse me, my voice is going.
Oh, can't have that.
the last I heard was that the object was taken out of the museum in Harare and had been taken away by President Mugabe's people and taken to his private residence. And a lot of people in Harare were saying that this was the case, and I haven't heard recently what's become of the ark. I believe it's probably back in the museum, but the full story of what's happened with her for the last few years hasn't yet been told. It'd be interesting to know. But apparently Mugabe himself believed in the Ark and allegedly used the Ark for his own kind of purposes. He's a very superstitious man, apparently.
And you could almost imagine any military leader would be tempted at the notion that having a piece of something which made anybody invisible, especially if he were superstitious, he would want that for himself.
I heard, but I don't know whether it's true, was that he put water into it and then he would drink the water as a way of maintaining his potency and his control over the people of Zimbabwe. Of course, he's no longer in power, but he had a pretty good term of office. My goodness.
So that again, then that backs up what was said. Then I think in that Fox News article that, and I was just sort of struck by this. It said, you know, nobody knows where the actual Ark of the Covenant is hiding or whether it really exists. I think what that disseminating between the difference between the Ark of the Covenant and the Ark of War, and suggesting that this Ark of War was really a drum, a big wooden drum, something of a drum shape anyway, might explain why it would be carried into battle, and that it could, given, you know, some sort of. If it made a sound, it could be very intimidating to an opponent. I mean, for the reason that some, you know, as British troops would have bagpipes that would go into war, or why Native American traditions had, you know, whooping and other things that they did, you know, just to try to intimidate the other person that they were about to fight into putting down their weapons and running away. That's the best fight you can have is when the other side gives up out of fear. So it in the end, I mean, or where do you stand currently on what that in, how was it pronounced, Ngono, the drum?
Ngoma. I think, you know, if you look at the biblical text with an impartial eye and look at, and contextualize it, you know, you've got King David dancing in front of this thing, right? And well, you know, a drum is something that you would dance in front of. If you think of, you know, Joshua fought the Battle of Jericho, the famous song. And so what happened was that Joshua went round the walls of Jericho and the walls came tumbling down. We don't know why they came tumbling down, but we do know that the Ark followed a kind of band of composed of trumpets, and the Israelites blew on the trumpets, and the Ark is part of this kind of procession around the walls of Jericho. It's conceivable this also that it had some kind of music. It was definitely in the context of other musical instruments anyway, and we don't quite know what it was. Nobody is ever going to know exactly what it was, and the biblical text is far from clear. But anyway, in the Lemba tradition, it was a kind of drum, and we don't know how it worked. But one can imagine that you know, drum beats can be very, very disconcerting. They can drive people mad, and you know, particular rhythms get under your skin. They're disconcerting. They throw you out of kilter, and one could imagine something along these lines without being, you know, very specific, because we don't know.
So it is then that you sort of turned into a new field of research, or an extension, I guess, really, of your work with the Lemba tribe and with the Ethiopians in your pursuit of other Jewish communities in the diaspora in places that perhaps some people might not associate that, for example, in India. Tell us about your current work.
Well, what I was working on for quite a few years is this. It's very interesting, I think, that today there are about 15 million Jews in the world, and it's not very many, and that is, however, the number. And in addition to this number of 15 million Jews, there are about 15 million people in the world who believe that they're Jews, but who are not accepted as Jews by Jews. And these second 15 million, the shadow people of Israel, as you might think of them, are scattered all over the place. So throughout Africa, there are millions of people who believe that they are of Jewish origin through, in places like Brazil and Central America and South America and the Far East. There are groups of people who believe that they're connected with some ancient Jewish diaspora. And in addition to these people, there are, of course, many remote Jewish communities. Last year I was in Azerbaijan, where there's an intriguing community of so-called mountain Jews. In China, there's an ancient community of Chinese Jews. And in India, there is a group in Western India, in and around Mumbai, which again has got very, very intriguing and interesting history. And which also, through DNA, we were able to associate with other Jewish communities throughout the world. So DNA, in fact, in terms of understanding Jewish history, has been quite a powerful and interesting tool.
How does any of these identities, these group identities, how does that scientific evidence or the connection, the genetic evidence, how does that inform our understanding of what it means when people say the lost tribes of Israel?
Well, it's interesting. The actual lost tribes, which is to say the 10 tribes that were taken out of the land of Israel about 2,700 years ago, and they were taken east into Assyria. These tribes, you can really imagine to have disappeared. In any event, we don't have any knowledge of them. And, you know, there was a bit of information which seeped through the historical record for a couple of generations after this exodus of Israelites to the east, through military records. So you'd have names of Assyrian soldiers written in cuneiform on clay tablets. And for a couple of generations, you would see these Jewish names, David, Ben, something or another, or Israel, you know, the son of Jeremiah or something of this sort. And but then that kind of disappeared, and one can imagine that they simply were absorbed into the population of Assyria. And so from that point on, really the kind of, you know, the story disappears, but is kept alive through the religious belief that one day the lost tribes would be rediscovered and would eventually find their way back to the land of Israel. And this was true of Judaism, and it was also true of Christianity. And so you've got this myth of the return of the lost tribes, or the myth of the continuing existence of the lost tribes somewhere in the world, which was a hugely, massively powerful factor in the way that the world was imagined from early days throughout the medieval period, and even today, because there are an awful lot of kind of lost tribe enthusiasts out there who believe that, you know, they really are still to be found somewhere, and hardly a year goes by. In fact, I'm sure no year ever goes by without somebody coming up and saying, hey, I found one of the lost tribes of Israel in outer Manchuria or something.
Right.
Now, in outer Manchuria, there may very well be a group of Jews or lost Jews or a kind of lost tribe in that sense, which has no real kind of relevance for understanding what happened to the lost tribes of Israel 2,700 years ago.
Because that's a very specific reference, that this is Israel, who is Israel's son, who had formerly been named Jacob, and his sons became the tribes. So that's a very, there is a, it's not just like the country of Israel, which I think may be what some people might think, that when they're talking about the lost tribe, that some people from Israel wandered off somewhere. That isn't quite it. So yeah, I think you're, I think you make an, a fair distinction.
Yes, by this time they had the tribal system in Israel, and the tribes inhabited different parts of the small country of Israel as we understand it today. And the Assyrians, in an act of ethnic cleansing, took some of them, and presumably the intellectuals, the upper classes, the influential people, and settled them in some eastern province of the empire. That's essentially what happened, and we don't know what happened to those people, and the likelihood of their being related to any of the weird and wonderful kind of marginal groups of Jews throughout the world is unlikely. I wouldn't say impossible. I would say it was unlikely.
I'm worried about the lost voice of Israel. You sound, and I'm so grateful because it sounds like this is something you've been struggling with throughout the evening, a slightly dry throat. Could I strike a bargain with you that if you'd give me a little time to answer some questions coming up for listeners who want to call in after the top of the hour, that you don't have to try to make it through the entire next hour? Would that be helpful?
I won't be able to do that because I have to be in church in about 10 minutes.
Get out. You have to be in church in 10 minutes?
You can't keep me away from church. You can't do that.
Well, I love that. Then we should go we'll be going the last hour without you then. I thought we had you, but I understand, and I actually feel better then given your voice.
I don't think I'd be able to talk for another hour, that's for sure.
Okay. All right, good. Well, then I'm glad I brought it up because otherwise I would have been. So we'll do open lines coming up in the last hour, and that's just fine. Help me, though, as we wrap things up. Since we started with the supposition that that this research is something that, you know, you started, but now you are onto other things. Are there other people who are following in your footsteps, who are continuing this research into, legitimate scholars, not opportunists, not people who are, you know, who are doing this to get on some sort of, you know, Christian TV station or something, but I mean, really legit researchers who are trying to find the lost Ark of the Covenant or the lost Ark of War. Is that still an ongoing thing, or is it just you kind of did the best that anybody could and nobody is following your trail?
No, I think some, you know, people are kind of interested in the way in which legends like this have informed events in Africa and elsewhere. I could mention one young and outstanding scholar. There are quite a number who are doing it, but there is there's one outstanding scholar by the name of Nathan DeVere, who's an American scholar at the University of Utah. In fact, he's the head of Middle Eastern Studies, and I believe he's the chair of the Department of Religious Studies there. And he's written a couple of books which are looking at the way in which legends, such as Israelite legends of different sorts, have impacted upon tribal beliefs in different parts of Africa. But there are quite a number like him, and I would say that, you know, worldwide, it's a growing field of study.
that you've done God's work. Enjoy your time at church this morning, and thank you, Tudor
yes.
Parfit. God
Forgive
bless you.
Me for not being able to speak any further.
You did wonderfully. You did heroic. That's truly amazing. Thank you. We'll go our last hour open lines next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.